And welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as a visiting research collaborator at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Stephen P. Turner of the University of South Florida, author of the compendium of essays that he's written over a long period of time entitled The Politics of Expertise, published this year by Routledge. You may wonder, as you tune into Hearsay Culture, a show that focuses primarily but not exclusively on intellectual property law, communications policy, technology policy, and the like, why would I be chatting with someone who is an expert in expertise? And, of course, if you think about it a little bit, right, this is an issue from a procedural standpoint which has become critically important in policymaking across a range of the IP and technology issues that we've talked about over the 8-plus-year history of Hearsay Culture, right, from the questions that were boggling us in 2005, 2006, like how do you handle digital rights management issues on iTunes, to questions that came up later, like privacy issues and social media, to questions that we deal with today regarding international trade law and how internet policy and IP policy issues arise in those contexts. Over and over again, what we find is that policymakers, both at the state, federal, and international level, are attempting to regulate in spaces that they just don't know that well. And as many of you know, I was very active in opposing the Stop Online Piracy Act a few years ago and wrote an article with a lack of policymaking and was able to use as the title of my article a quote from Representative Chaffetz of Utah, who in one of the hearings on SOPA and PIPA pointed out, somewhat famously now, that we needed to, quote, bring in the nerds in order to, or I think he actually said bring the nerds in order to understand what this law would have done to the operations of the Internet. And so when we think about policymaking, one of these very important questions but not well understood at all is the question of what the role of experts are in policymaking and more broadly in society. And so Stephen has written over the course of 25 years, a variety of articles on the question of expertise, from articles which, again, are all assembled in his book, The Politics of Expertise, like fundamental questions of what is the problem with experts, to expert power and how power and bargaining and negotiation and decision-making impact with experts, to a variety of case studies involving the use of expertise, and the role, specifically, given oftentimes what we look for in experts, the role of science inside policymaking. So scientists as agents is another focus of the book, as well as a very detailed and useful analysis of the theory and philosophy underlying expertise as we think about it in policymaking. Very interestingly, one of the areas that we think about more broadly in expertise, of course, is the question of what information is available and how that information may be made available. And increasingly in the history of Hearsay Culture, we have focused more heavily on information law and policy as it develops. And so this work on expertise that Stephen has put together, it fits very nicely into that broader question. As we think about the role of experts and what we might want experts to do or not do in decision-making and policy-making, it's important to have a granular understanding of who experts are and what they're about and what their capabilities and limitations are and why policymakers might want to deal with or not deal with experts. And so I'm excited to have Stephen on the show today to talk about this work. By way of background, Stephen is the distinguished university professor at the University of South Florida College of Arts and Sciences. He has focused on these questions literally for 25 years. He's an author of a number of books in the history of philosophy of social science, including books on Max Weber. He's also edited volumes dealing with his work. He's written a few other books which are also terrific, including one called Liberal Democracy 3.0, which came out about 10 years ago, which has also been influential potential in this area and part of this broader study of expertise. The Politics of Expertise, the book that we're going to discuss today, was published this year by Routledge, and he also focuses on issues involving normativity, especially the conflict between philosophical and social scientific accounts and issues related to the implications of cognitive neuroscience for social theory, especially related to a topic that we're going to talk about at least for a few minutes towards the end of our discussion, what Stephen refers to as, quote, tacit knowledge, and what that means. He is joining us from his home in St. Petersburg, Florida, and we are recording on November 25th, 2014 for, yes, airing on Thanksgiving Day 2014, but recognizing that this is a podcast, I do not expect you to leave your family table to listen to the show, although if you want to, I certainly encourage it, and it will be at 10 a.m. Pacific time, so that will be possible. At any rate, Stephen, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Great. Thanks. Glad to be here.
So, Stephen, let me ask you a bit more about your background. Perhaps you could talk a bit more about that background and how you became interested in expertise as a scholarly topic.
Well, I started out actually in sociology, and I became interested in the philosophy of social science, and then did philosophy as well. And because I had those two particular backgrounds, it happened that at the time, in the early 70s, there was kind of a revolution going on in science studies, and it took the form of a kind of challenge by people doing empirical studies of scientific controversies to the received philosophical views of the way science supposedly worked. And so I was more or less drawn into this discussion just because of my background, and started writing on it. And I decided that, gee, if I was going to be a real participant, I had to earn my chops in the same way that the other people did. And what they were doing was detailed case studies where they were actually following scientists around and hanging around different communities. That wasn't really, I did a bit of that. I worked on some geological journal archives, for example, because they were convenient to me. But I didn't do the sort of full case study thing, but instead I decided to work on the things that I knew a little bit more about, which was complex organizations and the organization of science generally. So I started working on history of geology, and in particular on the history of the U.S. Geological Survey and the state geological surveys that preceded that. And my interest there was not really in expertise at that time, but in patronage and in the problem of why it is that Democratic legislatures were so willing to invest so much money in science in the middle of the and early part of the 19th century in the U.S. So there's a famous discussion in Tocqueville on Democracy in America where he says, well, science is an aristocratic affair. You can't expect it to flourish in democratic societies. Yet by the end of the century, the U.S. Geological Survey was the biggest scientific organization in the world. So the question for me is how that happened if Tocqueville was to be believed. So that, it's the beginning of the problem of expertise, because it's the same kind of asymmetry of knowledge between the geologists and the people paying for the geology that happens with expertise in policy contexts and things like that. And it, as it happened, the geology business turned, the political aspect of the geology business turned into a major policy dispute that eventually cost John Wesley Powell, who was the leading figure in this, his job at the Geological Survey. So it's very rich empirical material about how this stuff actually works. And mostly it hadn't been thought through in terms of sort of epistemic or hadn't been thought through as a problem of knowledge, basically. It had been thought through as a political problem and sometimes in very sort of stylized and superficial ways. So I spent a lot of time trying to reconstruct what happened in those contexts. And that just led to more discussions of this problem of how it is that scientific, how trust in science occurs, especially in the context of how you organize it. So I found that there was some characteristic. If you're looking at the foundings of very successful scientific organizations, there are some characteristic relationships or types of people who were central to making that happen. But after working on, and then after that, I worked a lot on foundation archives. So I got to see how it is that the foundation officers constructed their problem of having a career and subsidizing science at the same time. So there's lots of very interesting, empirical, historical background material to work with. But after that, I was also working completely separately on some topics in political theory, and I was invited to a conference at Vanderbilt about in 1992, I guess, which was on liberal democracy. So I decided to think about the problem of experts in liberal democracy, and that really got me started on a whole new track of looking at the problem of how it is that the state manages its relationship with experts and how experts manage their relationship with the state, with the public, and so on, and how that contributes to or alters the what we normally think of as a democratic process.
Now, your work, and I want to talk about that expertise because, as I mentioned in the introduction, we certainly grapple with it regularly on the technology policy side. As a scholar focused on in philosophy, how do you work and philosophy and theories involving information into this question of expertise? Before we actually define expert, and if you'd like to do that now as well, that would be great. How you define it? How does philosophy fit into the analysis that you have been engaging?
Well, partly it fits in as a kind of critique of social science theories generally. So one of the interesting features of a lot of social science theories is that, if you look at organizational studies or economics, they assume questions of knowledge away. They might, in economics, is often the assumption of equal knowledge, makes things very convenient. And so there's a sub-area of economics that looks at asymmetric knowledge or asymmetric information. So like when you go in to buy a used car, they know what's wrong with it and you don't. And so you can theorize about that, but that becomes very complicated and it's much easier for them to just assume those problems away. And that's true as well for other areas of social science. So if you're looking at organizational structure or social movements or political movements, it's pretty convenient to just not worry about the fact that everybody participating in the activity knows different stuff. And some people know a lot of esoteric stuff and other people know very little. That actually determines much of what they actually do. So assuming it away is probably not a good idea, both theoretically, in terms of actually understanding the processes, but it's very kind of difficult to then think about the way knowledge actually interacts with all of these other kinds of difficult enough to understand phenomena. So I'm trying to sort of bring knowledge back in to these arguments.
And it seems like, Stephen, as I hear you describe your work, right? Bringing knowledge back into expertise, I think, you know, moves it away from what I think, and this is more of a question, it has generally been thought of, that is experts as a function of either, it is some kind of administrative process or really just one, input in a broader scheme. You write a bit about expertise, and focusing on experts as kind of a field that doesn't have an easy home. And perhaps you could talk for a few minutes about that, reconfiguration of expertise as a function of knowledge, and how that fits into, if it does, broader, scholarly endeavors.
Yeah, well, you're quite right that it doesn't really have a good home, although there are a lot of people very interested now in issues about expertise. There was a conference put together a year and a half ago at the University of British Columbia, which tried to bring in 30 different people from different perspectives that had something to say about expertise. And it was a veritable Tower of Babel. No one really could say anything that was really compelling to anybody else, because everybody had their own little framework or set of problems that they were operating in, and often they were just astonished at what other people said and didn't find it very relevant to their own problems. So, and that's actually a more or less typical problem of expertise itself. So one of the things that I did in the book, and one of the first things I did in working in this area, was to look at situations where you had multiple forms of expertise that were duking it out in relation to some kind of policy. And the example I discuss in the book is water policy in the West. And this was one of the most, you know, if you live in the West, you know this, but it's one of the most tangled, screwed up set of policy decisions with very long-term consequences and very difficult questions to resolve. But in the initial discussions of these things were prompted basically by the fact that homesteading was sort of the welfare system of the 19th century. People could go and get free land, so you didn't have to take care of them. And when the land that was well watered ran out, people then went to land and got it on the same acreage and basis that they had before, except that they couldn't over the long run make a go of it as a farm. And so this produced a tremendous amount of conflict and controversy. So one of the problems was that the rains came in cycles, and John Wesley Powell knew that the people were moving into land that was fertile enough and had enough water at the moment, but was going to dry out, and there was no way of sustaining it. And so he wanted to get some method of granting land that would tie it to water rights so that people would have sustainable units to work in. And so that ran into a lot of political problems, legal problems, because it there was no format for legally tying these lands to water rights, and all of this had to be dealt with lawyers. There were disputes about the geology. There was a dispute over the question of whether it might be the case that the rain followed the plow. That was a famous theory in the 19th century. So that cultivation itself might somehow generate more water. So all of these issues were had to be settled, and there was just no easy solution to them. And so it's an interesting case of experts of different kinds with different areas, lawyers, geologists, and people who are concerned with essentially public policy couldn't work it out to come to a solution. And I think that's actually a model for a lot of present-day policy discussions. You've got people that know completely different things. They try to impose a solution that's based on the stuff that they know, and other people try to impose a solution based on quite different things that they're expert on, and getting it all to mesh is very difficult. That's, I think, the core of a lot of policy problems.
We're chatting with Professor Stephen Turner, Distinguished University Professor at the University of South Florida, on KZSO FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Stephen, let me ask you this, because I think you referred to it, but and maybe this is such an academic question, you'll say it doesn't require a definition, but what's an expert? Is there a definition that you think of when you think of the attributes that qualify someone as an expert? And I don't mean that in a legal sense, because of course in litigation, for example, one has to be certified or qualified as an expert, but from the perspective of the work that you do, what's your definition?
I'm not very happy with the idea that you can get meaningful definitions about these things. Mm-hmm. But one thing that you can do is to break down the category into more manageable units. So that's really what I have done with the concept of expertise. So I've looked at experts in terms of different kinds of experts and their different kinds of relations to their audiences. So if you're a physicist, you've got the physics community, and the community itself is regarded externally by the public as expert. That's a nice model, and lots of people would like to be treated as expert in that way, but that's not in the way they actually are treated as experts. So you've got other kinds of experts who are things like diet gurus or psychotherapists with particular therapies that they're pushing. And that's a kind of a different relationship, where the audience isn't just expected to believe what they say, but actually consumes the expertise and tests it out in their own lives, and believes them or disbelieves them based on their experience with it. And they're in a market, so they're not quite in a community that validates their expertise. It's validated by their success in actually serving people or persuading people that they're served. And then there's a lot of other expertise that's a little bit more complex, which has to do with the fact that politicians like to dump off problems on experts, whether or not there's any very profound expertise there. So it's a good way of taking a problem out of politics to defer to experts. So historically, things like juvenile justice were sort of aggressively campaigned in terms for reforms, in terms of expertise, which wasn't really expertise. It was really just a certain set of progressive reform ideas in the late 19th century. And politicians who wanted this problem off their back were very happy to say, okay, let's do everything they say. Let's set up a system of juvenile courts. Let's set up a system of reform schools and all of this sort of stuff. And the problem didn't go away. It just got worse. But the problem was taken off of the political plate. So then people get expertise in operating within systems like that, and they know a lot. They know a lot that the rest of us don't know, and so they're experts in that sense. So I could go on. There are probably other categories that we could look at, but I was interested in particularly in which of these are actually politically problematic.
And that's really going to be my next question. So that leads us also into our break, and then I want to get into some of those philosophical underpinnings. But as we think about the problem of expertise from a political standpoint, and the issue being one of knowledge. You know, I mentioned in my introduction, you know, what at least I and others perceived to be a problem, which was that Congress was attempting to regulate the internet without talking to computer scientists and engineers and the like. And it was only when they heard via letter from a number of engineers that there was any pause on the technological side. You know, do we have a problem of expertise or the role of expertise in policymaking today? And if so, what are those areas to which I think you were about to refer?
Well, I think there, the way I look at it is that there are some just generic problems with expertise that need to be understood. So it's, there isn't a single solution to the problem of how you essentially relate knowledge and power. It's got to be organized. You've got to have categories of people who have different forms of authority. You've got to somehow take the knowledge that's out there and turn it into a decision, and that can be really difficult. And so one of the examples I deal with is the Columbia shuttle disaster. And if you look at NASA at and the way it organizes these space missions, it's incredibly complicated. You have about 5,000 items that are mission critical, meaning if they go wrong, that they actually have, they are problems, and if they go wrong, it would cause the mission to fail. But then if you think of organizationally, okay, so if you had 5,000 problems, each of which has a group of engineers responsible for it, how do you take all of that knowledge about these very specialized aspects of the process and of the technology and turn it into a decision to launch or not launch or to change the technology or whatever? And the problem is that the detailed knowledge is very specialized, and so it doesn't really help to say, oh, well, it should just be run by engineers, because they're not the right kinds of engineers. Nobody could possibly know enough to handle 5,000 different highly technical questions. So it's got to be organized. And it's got to be organized in terms of some set of procedures for raising questions, resolving questions, having them brought to a higher level that makes more decisions about how it's supposed to be handled and how that knowledge is supposed to be conveyed. Gets very complicated very fast, and there are inevitably, no matter how you would design a system like this, there are going to be trade-offs that incur risks and things that are going to go wrong. And I think that's just true generally for policy, that there's a lot of different specialized pieces of knowledge out there that have to be put together. There's no magic formula for how that's done. There's some interesting models that exist historically and are used today, and each of them has its issues. So my interest in part is just describing some of those different structures of aggregating knowledge and asking where they might go wrong.
We're chatting with Professor Stephen Turner of the University of South Florida, author of the book The Politics of Expertise on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture and to the show. So Stephen, who are the philosophers that are primarily instructive to you on these questions? You discuss a number of them in a few of the chapters of the book, but when you think of the philosophers that today would be most useful for policymakers and really for the public to understand the issue of knowledge and expertise, who would you point them to?
That's a good question. I'm not sure any of them really help very much with the problem of expertise as it relates to policy. There's a huge amount of discussion nowadays about values in science and what the proper relationship between science and society should be. And there's a real sea change in these discussions where in the past, this gets into a lot of history that might not be terribly interesting, but is necessary in a way to understand this. But in the past, there was a view of science as autonomous, and that its autonomy ought to be protected, that the state shouldn't muck around in telling scientists what to do, that science should grow organically in terms of its own problems, and the way its practitioners saw its problems. And that has been really undermined by the funding system and by scientists themselves sort of buying into the notion that they need to have an impact with on policy with the science that they do. And so we now have philosophers who are working very hard to justify or think through what it is that the correct relationship between science and not only the state but society generally should be. So Heather Douglas is, I think, the best person writing on this, and Philip Kitcher at Columbia has a couple books on this as well. But it's I just got back from a philosophy of science meeting, and there was a considerable amount of discussion by a lot of people on this problem. I must say I'm a bit skeptical about this line of argument, but as a practical matter, we're in a different configuration in science than we were 50 years ago, and that's something that needs, I think, to be understood, and it's very difficult really to understand exactly what's going on.
Well, Stephen, this is, Hearsay Culture is about science, and I will tell you, to make you feel more comfortable, because I'm now going to ask you to go into more detail. You said it may not be interesting, but I'm going to differ with you on that, based upon what I know of my audience. And I will tell you that a few years ago I had an expert on who was discussing the history of moving obelisks through Egypt. So this is the right, I think, venue to get into some of that history. So I'm going to open up the floor to you. You just said there's something that there's things that need to be understood here that are not well understood. Enter Hearsay Culture. So please, educate my listeners. But go in a bit more detail about that history, because I suspect, based upon my own much more limited experience, that's right, and we don't have a good framing for where we are. So please.
So let me go back to the thrilling days of yesteryear here for a moment. And, almost all of your listeners will have read Thomas Kuhn. So the structure of scientific revolution is all about the nature of the scientific community and the fact that it's really difficult to change people's minds about major things in science, that there are sort of ways of thinking or paradigms that are very resistant to change and ignore new evidence and so on and so forth. And that now and then there's a revolution where one of these things collapses and a new paradigm is put in its place and so on. Now, what's interesting about, historically about Kuhn is that this was the product, and it actually has a very different flavor. It was the product of a liberal reaction to what was essentially the communist view of science in the 30s. So that was an interpretation of science that basically saw science as a form of technology and that it delivered, you know, absolute judgments, and that it could be applied then to the economy, and so on and so forth. So this is very much associated with the planning movement of the 30s. And in reaction to that, there was a chemist, a physical chemist named Michael Polanyi, whose son was a Nobel laureate. Polanyi started a movement against this sort of left-wing interpretation of the role of science. Now, one of the big calling cards of the left-wing interpretation of science was things that you're that sound very familiar, that the authoritarian regimes were able to make decisions and utilize technology much more effectively than liberal democracies, which argued about things and didn't come to conclusions that were correct. And so the idea was, well, if you just handed over its authority to scientists organized in the form of trade unions, they could make the correct decisions and utilize scientific knowledge successfully for the advancement of society. And so one of the big concerns in the 30s was that, gee, we've got all of this science, and capitalism is incapable of taking advantage of it. They don't say that now, obviously. They're more concerned about capitalism taking too much advantage of science. Right. But that was the genesis of this viewpoint. So the alternative was to say, no, science is not technology. It's the important thing about science is discovery. And that happens only, or it happens most successfully in a community of scientists who are pretty much free agents, that they're capable of deciding what to research and utilizing their best knowledge of what the next set of possibilities is. So telling them how to do their research or telling them what research to do really would impede the progress of science. And this was a very powerful image, and it is the one that Kuhn inherits through James Bryant Conant, who was the president of Harvard, who was the American counterpart to Polanyi, and says very similar things about science as a community activity, about the tendency of scientists to ride hobby horses and to overrate the importance of their own specialty, a tendency to groupthink, and so on and so forth. So those were all issues that Conant at least saw as problems in the community of science, but he was actually a celebrant also of science as it actually operated. So they were trying to defend this model of sort of free and autonomous science. They were very concerned with the problem of what happens when researchers can't freely choose the projects that they think are best. So they were concerned with the funding system, and they wanted to fund scientists rather than projects. For example. So they didn't win all, they won the intellectual battle in the sense that people began to think of science as a community of a particular kind that regulated itself and needed to have its autonomy from the state. But the reality was, especially after the atomic bomb, that there was now this phenomenon of big science, and the state was, whether it wanted to or not, was going to be a big player in directing where science went, and the more money that was involved, the more direction was going to take place, because politicians were going to ask for value for their money. And gradually, science evolved in a somewhat different way that reflected just the realities of science as a very costly activity dependent on outside support. So that's sort of where we are, you know, that's what we've come to now. So now there's a whole gaggle of terms for this, but we call it things like post-academic science or post-normal science. And that's really the intellectual problem I think we've got, or sometimes techno-science. Our problem is to figure out, okay, really what kind of animal is this? It's not like that old community of autonomous scientists working on their own problems without any direction from anybody else. They're all pretty intimately involved with one another and with their funders. And those funding that community determines really what science actually gets done. And that's a long way away from that kind of liberal ideal.
Do you expect, and we're chatting with Stephen Turner of the University of South Florida on KCSF-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, you know, are there those, you know, if you will, independent or non-affiliated scientists and experts out there? You know, because I'm thinking, as you know, as you refer to it at the end there, right, even in the academic settings, there is funding involved. And, of course, there's been some fairly high-profile exposés, if you will, over the last few years about academics who take policy positions, and then it turns out we're being backed by interest groups, and in some cases they were not transparent and didn't reveal the fact that that was happening. You know, is that a logical outcropping of, you know, what you refer to in the book and in your essays as the patronage issue in expertise?
Well, you've hit on really what's a big problem. And the problem is probably even more complicated than that. So one of the issues with policy-related research is that it tends to develop in such a way that it excludes alternative voices. So it's consensus-oriented, and if you don't support the consensus, you don't get your research funded. So, and then that happens especially with when there's a government program that's got a group of people who have a particular policy agenda, or the government itself has a policy agenda, and a research community is created around the policy agenda to support that policy agenda. So you got the same problem on the other side, where you've got people opposing those policy agendas. They've got to get their money someplace, and so they go to whoever it is that's opposed to those policy agendas and so forth. And obviously, there is no, as long as you need money, and you do, there isn't any real escape from the need to hook up with some either community or supporters that share your views and expect you to do the research that comes out in a way that favors them. And so this is a design problem that is very different from the design problem of autonomous science. So we have this sort of historical image inherited from people like Karl Popper that, you know, science is about conjectures and refutations. It's about people disproving things and testing other people's claims and blah, blah, blah. But in the policy domain, that's actually something that's considered to be something that needs to be suppressed. So the NIH, for example, was running for many years these consensus conferences where they wanted to hasten the development of consensus by bringing all the people who had worked in some area together to come up with some kinds of what it is that we know that we agree on that we can give to policymakers. So that's kind of artificial consensus as opposed to the natural one that happens just through the ongoing criticism and debate within a scientific community. So, but that model is gone. We don't really have the kind of open policy debates within the academic community anymore. And a lot of that is necessarily just shifted out to these policy shops that have sort of ideologically oriented backers of one kind or another. So if you go to Washington, every one of these organizations has a political flavor that they're tagged with. And you nevertheless have, so you have a new kind of public debate in policy where everybody has basically got an axe to grind, and you fight it out in front of the larger political public. That's different from arriving at an expert consensus and presenting it to the public.
So when we think about where we are now, you know, you refer to expertise as also being directly, and you refer to in your initial answer, as a function of the inequality of knowledge. How is expertise used, if it is, used in a way to maintain inequalities, if you will, or are you suggesting merely that by virtue of being an expert, one is by definition more knowledgeable, and therefore that in and of itself creates policy issues? So I guess the question boils down to how much should we make of the inequality of knowledge as you define it in expertise in decision-making and policy-making?
I'll give you a kind of historical answer to that. You know, Condorcet wrote something that was only published after he was executed, and it was about exactly this problem. You want democracy, but not everybody knows the same stuff. And some people have special knowledge that's very difficult to acquire, that's essentially inaccessible to the rest of the public. So how do you organize that? And the standard answer to this is, well, education, but the education is really designed to make people appreciate the greater wisdom and knowledge of scientists and particular experts in general. So that assumes that there's some kind of ineradicable inequality about knowledge. We just can't assume that all democratic citizens can be equal participants in questions that involve this kind of specialized knowledge of one kind or another. And so we delegate, we can organize this in various ways. So if it's economic knowledge, well, we have the Fed, and those people have high academic qualifications. They're technically competent economists. Let's let them make the decisions and not have it a matter of public discussion the way it was a century ago, for example. So that's kind of where if you're an egalitarian, this should be a problem for you, because this is a kind of ineradicable kind of inequality. But it's not an inequality that works in a normal sense of social classes or something like that, because experts don't really form a group. They're expert about very specific and usually fairly narrow things. So the problem isn't so much that they're going to rule as a collective body. The problem is to figure out how to make decisions in the face of the reality that there is such a wide distribution of specialized knowledge of different kinds that bear on the policies.
Does the internet, as you see it, Stephen, level the playing field in any way between experts and non-experts? In other words, right, the proverbial Googling of everything that gives people to some degree specialized knowledge, even if it doesn't obviously approximate having a PhD or immersing yourself in it. But is there a way that the internet, or does the internet impact the analysis, and particularly, again, more broadly, the ready availability of information that also, you know, runs not just through the internet but even through Twitter, right, in bytes and bits?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So I was at a conference on science communication in Britain last summer where we had lots of discussions of these problems. And one of the discussions that there were also many blog discussions after this. one of the discussions we got into had to do with the fact that the scientists tended to see most of what was on the internet as garbage, and so from their point of view, actually what you got from these sites was just wrong, and it made you even stupider than you were before. So they had a very strong view of, we understand what these processes are, you don't, and you never will. So it certainly didn't lend itself to the idea that sort of active citizenship could be pursued by browsing internet sites.
We're well into what I call Stephen, the unfair portion of the show, where I ask questions that you don't have time to answer adequately. And so, but then I ask them anyway, in the, you know, in the, mores of our time. So if you're, you know, if you are, you know, advising decision makers today in how best to understand expertise and utilize experts in complex decision making, and again, more specifically, to use science, you know, what would you want policymakers to understand from your work today?
Yeah, so I think the answer to that question is to turn it around. I think the real problems have to do not so much with the policymakers, but with the experts communicating with the policymakers. So experts are very bad at certain things, and this is what I call in the book, I take the German phrase, competence, which is applied to courts, which says courts in Germany, certain kinds of courts, at least like constitutional courts, don't have competence, meaning they can't decide what cases to take. Well, it's true for experts, too, that they're not really good at knowing what their limits are, and understanding other people's problems, especially other people's specialized problems. So it's very often the case that they have to put themselves into the minds of the policymaker and appreciate the different kinds of considerations and information that the policymaker has to deal with in order to effectively communicate with the policymaker. There's just a big gap between, specialists and people making policy, which is a much more complex process involving different kinds of knowledge and so on and so forth. So I'll give you one little anecdote on this. There was a meeting outside Washington where with some congressmen, and they were asked more or less this same kind of question: is what, you know, how do you handle expert knowledge, and which experts do you trust? And they all said the same thing: they trusted the lobbyists. And that sounds like a very strange answer, but the justification was pretty straightforward: that the lobbyists had a continuing relationship with them, they couldn't lie to them, and they generally could understand and articulate both sides of an issue, and the experts couldn't. The experts had their line and what they thought needed to be done, and didn't have much appreciation or even willingness to appreciate the different sides and also the implications of a policy decision. So I think that's sad, but I think that means that the experts, to be effective, have to up their game and understand the issues that face the people that they're talking to.
Was that answer to you, Stephen? And I'll take one more minute. As counterintuitive, I mean,
I was very surprised by that answer. It wasn't, after I thought about it, it wasn't so counterintuitive. And I thought, you know, back to the cases that I'd looked in right in the 19th century, that that was probably right, that the people who the scientists in the 19th century that got into trouble with the state were mostly not very adept politically, meaning they didn't really understand the needs of the counterparty.
Professor Stephen Turner, the distinguished university professor at the University of South Florida College of Arts and Sciences, author of the book that came out this year, a compendium of essays entitled "The Politics of Expertise" by Routledge, published by Routledge. Stephen, this issue, as I mentioned in the beginning, critically important and perhaps one of the least understood of any topic that I could pick on Hearsay Culture. But I think your work has certainly helped me understand it, and undoubtedly my listeners. So thank you very much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you.
So next week is our last show for this quarter on KZSU's schedule, and I'm delighted to have on the show next week Professor Danielle Citron, who will be on discussing her book on cyberbullying and hate crimes on the Internet. And then through the rest of December and really into the beginning of next year, Hearsay Culture will be on hiatus as KZSU is in its interim schedule. But I'm excited about the guests coming up on the show beginning in January, including Biela Coleman, author of the anthropological study of the group Anonymous, as well as Nabia Syed, who's going to be speaking about the First Amendment on the Internet, and Lisa Lynch from Concordia University, who's going to be talking about and discussing her work on leaking websites and WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and the like. I am in the process of booking other guests for Hearsay Culture's winter quarter, which begins in January of 2015. You can email me with any suggestions you have for guests at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you can listen to the show this quarter, 10 a.m. Pacific time on Thursdays by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society. And then I'm very happy to say that I believe I've mostly rebuilt the website for Hearsay Culture that had been attacked through the wonderful help of Oliver Day and his group Securing Change. So you can go to hearsayculture.com where you can get all of the previous 220-plus shows as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me much today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.